Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The answer is America's favorite game show. If you're not saying what is Jeopardy right now, author Claire McNear is here to change your mind. She's the author of Answers in the Form of Questions, a definitive history and insider's guide to Jeopardy. Jeopardy has been a television mainstay for 36 years and, according to Claire, is pretty much one of the last pieces of monoculture we have left. So we decided to zoom in with Claire to find out why, and also to challenge her to a beta version of Jeopardy. I'll be posing answers to her, and she'll be providing provocative questions. Claire says that a big reason for Jeopardy's longevity was the hard work and universal likability factor of my fellow Canadian, the late Alex Trebek.
A beautiful thing about him was that he was really exactly who he seemed like he was on the show. I mean, he was a very kind of scholarly person who really cared about all these silly facts. He really thought they were important and built Jeopardy into this kind of corner of the world where that was revered, which felt, you know, especially precious in recent years, I think. He also really did have a sense of humor about it, though. You know, he was not the kind of uncharitable Saturday Night Live Will Ferrell character of himself, where he looked down on his contestants and couldn't wait to get out of there. And, you know, just he was the only one who knew anything.
And finally, with negative $130,000, Sean Connery is here yet again.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, Trebek. I turned down Harry friggin' Potter for this.
Please, God, take me now.
He was really very charitable and had a great sense of humor about it.
What did Alex Trebek think of Will Ferrell's impersonation of him?
Yeah, this is one of the questions that Alex Trebek would always get asked. People always wanted to know, hey, aren't you offended by that? Isn't that mean? And in a way, you would think that he would have been, because it is just this extremely uncharitable depiction of him, really, where he's mean, he's condescending. But in fact, he loved it. He loved those sketches. He so had a sense of humor about himself. You know, I think it was all in good fun. And he himself had some cameos on SNL and brought Will Ferrell into Jeopardy. So they kind of had this back and forth interplay. But he actually said that he always preferred the Eugene Levy version. And he said that the reason for that was because Eugene Levy was even ruder, even meaner, even angrier.
The answer is, this Jeopardy champion once told Claire McNear that this is the Moneyball era of Jeopardy.
You know, I think I've heard that from a couple different contestants, but I think who is Ken Jennings?
Yes.
Ken told me that, and he also, you know, graciously wrote the foreword to my book. So he talked a bit about this kind of professionalization that I was mentioning earlier. He compared contestants nowadays to fighter pilots, where they're getting hours and hours and hours and hours in the tank before they ever walk into the Jeopardy studio. Like in the old days, maybe you'd make 100 flashcards. You know, you just get the presidents down. Maybe you'd flip through an almanac, and you were like, okay, I'm ready for Jeopardy. Not so anymore.
What's the origin story of Jeopardy?
It goes back to the 1950s quiz show scandals, where there were these, you know, controversies around mega popular quiz shows like 21. And basically, the producers had been helping those contestants cheat, had been giving them the answers, you know, helping them study, having their opponents throw games, really just like doctoring storylines. So it became a huge, huge scandal. It was front page news, and there was a congressional hearing, and a bunch of the contestants who did this, it was like a couple dozen of them, were convicted of perjury, and it was a sensation. And after that, Congress amended the Communications Act to effectively make cheating on a quiz show illegal. There is a federal law dictating this. So in the years after that, Merv Griffin, the kind of game show impresario who also invented Wheel of Fortune, was speaking with his wife, and she had the idea of just flipping it around and doing exactly what was now verboten, what was now illegal, and just give the answer to the contestants as a way to kind of like thumb their nose at this new law that had sort of made it so quiz shows didn't really happen anymore because everybody was so spooked. And it, of course, became the sensation. And I mean, it is a gimmick to some degree, though, the what is, who is format, but it is so catchy And it really does have this beautiful history within the broader history of television.
As you say in your book, two of the main areas of preparing to be a Jeopardy contestant are the buzzer and the subject matter. Let's talk about both of these, starting with the buzzer. How important is being good with the buzzer to being successful on Jeopardy?
Oh my God, it is so important. And that is one of the things that people really obsess over as they prepare to go on the show. The way the buzzer works on Jeopardy is, as the host, as Alex Trebek, reads a clue, there is a person sitting at the judge's table just off stage that you can kind of see along that line, who's a researcher when they're not actually taping shows, but when they are, he is listening to Trebek. And the moment Trebek finishes the last word of a clue, he flips a literal switch in front of him, and that activates these lights that you can't see when you're watching on television, but these lights along the sides of the board. And that tells the three contestants that the buzzers have been activated. And why that matters is if they ring in even a fraction of a second before those lights go on, they're locked out for a quarter of a second, which on Jeopardy is a really big deal because your opponents are probably going to swoop in and get it instead. The trickiest thing, though, is you don't really know if you've got it until you're there in the Jeopardy studio that day. Each new contestant gets just a really brief morning warm-up session actually behind the contestant lecterns with the actual buzzers where they play part of a practice game, you know, for not any money. And they get just a moment to, you know, maybe get the hang of the buzzer. But if they realize, oh my God, I keep going too early. I don't know what I'm doing. Sorry, like you're sent off. And the next time you pick up the buzzer, you will be playing your game of Jeopardy on camera.
Yeah. What did you learn about subject matter from talking to contestants and Jeopardy champions?
You can't really learn everything that's going to be in an episode of Jeopardy. There is this pervasive misconception that contestants are given a study guide that they'll prepare. Most contestants have about 4 weeks between being called, invited to come tape, and when they actually go in, and people do study, but they are certainly not giving a study guide because that would be a violation of that federal law. What they choose to do with that 4 weeks is really interesting. And so some very smart, analytically inclined people have tried various ways to basically dig into the vast reservoir of past Jeopardy episodes and figure out specifically what sorts of subjects appear in that. And some of them have been very successful as well.
Chuck Forrest is a 5-time Jeopardy champion and a former record holder. He had an innovative approach that he used when picking categories and clues off the board. It's called the Forrest Bounce. What is the Forrest Bounce?
If you think of watching a traditional episode of Jeopardy, almost any episode of Jeopardy that you might watch and might turn on any given Wednesday, people tend to move down the categories clue by clue. You start with the $100 or the $200 clue and you move down sequentially through the board. And what Chuck Forrest did is he decided that he thought he could get an advantage by confusing his opponents. And the way he did that was he just jumped all over the board kind of at random, low value clues, high value clues, just switching up categories. Because the categories usually have a vital clue about what the answer might be, right? It's not just telling you it's presidents, it's like presidents, but they've hidden a funny word in there somewhere, you know, and if you're not paying close attention, you're going to miss that clue and you're probably going to get the clue wrong. So he did that, and that has remained a popular strategy, and people have kind of finessed it a little bit. So James Holzhauer famously did not play top to bottom. He played across the bottom of the board and slowly worked his way up. And that wasn't the Forrest Bounce because he wasn't trying to confuse his opponent so much as he was just trying to rack up a lot of cash really quickly. But it is controversial with viewers, right? Because it also has this disorienting effect on people watching from their own couch.
Besides clue selection, the other major strategy that is important for success on Jeopardy is wagering. What did you find out about betting strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are kind of in a moment of change for that as well, because I think James Holzhauer showed that you could bet really aggressively. And, you know, if you had the trivia goods to back it up, you could make a lot of money. You could really box out your opponents pretty effectively. You also have to be really good at the buzzer. I mean, you have to be really good at a lot of things to play the way that he did. But I think that he showed that it is often worthwhile to be very aggressive with daily doubles, for example. And he was not the first to do this, of course. Like Alex Jacob famously did this. Arthur Chu famously did this. These other storied contestants who were able to rack up really large amounts of money and box out their opponents by taking kind of gutsy wagers. And I think the ones who have done that effectively are people who know specifically what categories they're good at. And not just saying like, well, you know, I was an English major, so probably I'm good at literature. These are people who know what Jeopardy means when there's a literature category. They know the like 350 books that Jeopardy is thinking about specifically. And they bet accordingly. It's a really kind of cold, rational choice that they make in this high stakes environment, which is of course why I think a gambler did quite well with it.
The answer is an audio daily double. Claire, you have $15,000 and you're currently leading. How much would you like to wager?
You know what? In spite of knowing that the experts say, you know, to go big, I'm a more cautious person, so I'm going to say $5,000.
Okay, $5,000. So not a true daily double, but a sizable amount, one-third. Here we go. The man behind this parody of a popular song by the Greg Kinne Band may be the reason that Jeopardy still exists today.
Oh, I know this one. Who is Weird Al Yankovic?
Absolutely. Well done. Very good, Claire. So, Claire, tell us, how did Weird Al and his song I Lost on Jeopardy ensure the existence of Jeopardy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I had heard rumors that he was somehow involved, that his parody of that song had somehow resulted in Jeopardy coming back with Alex Trebek, and the timeline kind of matches up. So I set about investigating this, and I got on the phone with Weird Al. Basically, what happened was he was a fan of the original Jeopardy as a child. He really loved the Art Fleming version in the 60s and 70s. And he, knowing nothing of the fact that Merv Griffin was in that moment trying to launch his own Jeopardy reboot with Alex Trebek, just started to create a parody. He was very early in his career, and it had nothing to do really with the modern iteration of the show that was about to happen. But it just so happened that his song came out and it was this sensation. There was so much nostalgia around Jeopardy and it really took off. Like it was really high up on the charts. And it was just as the new Jeopardy staff was being hired and just before Jeopardy came back on the air with Alex Trebek. And I think that it is widely thought that the success of that song and the nostalgia that it kind of brought about had a lot to do with the new Jeopardy taking off. Game shows are not traditionally a very stable business. Obviously, there are these kind of cherished stalwarts, but Alex Trebek had been out of work for a year. He had worked for a series of game shows that, you know, had lasted, I think the longest was maybe 3 seasons prior to Jeopardy. You know, there's a lot of turmoil in that. And because Weird Al had created this song, it may have really been the key to Jeopardy immediately finding that audience.
It's time now for Final Jeopardy. Today's Final Jeopardy category is acknowledgements. Claire McNear, you're leading with $25,000, a sizable lead, I might add. And now it's time to write down how much you'd like to wager. And are you ready for the answer?
I think I will go all in on this, see how it goes.
Okay, there you go, all in. So for $50,000, and if you are correct, this will give you the win. This colleague of Claire McNear first encouraged her to cover Jeopardy like a sport.
That is my my wonderful editor, Andrew Grudadaro, who really every time I wrote about Jeopardy, he was like, just go deeper, get weirder, like really just attack this thing and report it out. And, I remember writing a story about the buzzer when James Holzhauer was still in the middle of his streak. And it was 3,000 words long. It was way too long. It was just this ridiculous niche. Who wants this? Who cares? And he was just, you know, fully supportive of that. And it took off, and in a way it led to this book. So I'm so thankful for him and for the rest of my colleagues at The Ringer.
And well, you should be. Just one moment, Claire. I've got to talk to our judges. No, that's right, Claire. I regret to inform you. You probably didn't notice this, but you did not phrase it in the form of a question. But that's okay.
Oh, no.
We're gonna give it to you anyway because we're feeling generous today.
It's
so
very
way
gracious.
To go, way
oh,
to go,
man.
Claire McNear.
Jeopardy, you're cardinal sin.
You are our new Jeopardy champion with a total of $50,000. We'll see you back here tomorrow, which, of course, will just be a few hours later since we tape a bunch of shows in one day. So looking forward to that. Claire McNear, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire McNear is the author of Answers in the Form of Questions, a definitive history and insider's guide to Jeopardy. You can find out more about Claire and Jeopardy at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Eddie Muller, Ruman Alam, and Claire McNear.
I'd like to know about your podcast.
Subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You were escorted out of an Apple store.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
You were an underwear model.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
You get applause and money.